way is they're directing us to ordering us to do things. When I first started coming to this church 40 years ago, I got a lot of information. I even took some of it home and put it on my posted it for the week on my refrigerator. I haven't done that for a long time. So about 10 years ago, I detected you sort of edging toward commandments and not anything else.
I'm next.
I know, but how did it get back?
So what we have with humanism is a healthier focus. Perfect timing. I had 10 minutes. I used it all. Thank you.
Living our 10 commitments. Now, I know all of you are familiar with the Murphy's Law. Did you know that there's an O'Reilly corollary to that Murphy Law? The corollary to Murphy's Law by O'Reilly is that Murphy was an optimist. So what's going on right now is Mike and Caroline are running back and forth from room to room trying to continue this service, and we're having a good time. So let's continue. The American Humanist Association has published a teaching learning aid that is used for classroom instruction. We had hoped to copy that and have that showing during the presentation. That didn't happen. That's okay. What the poster shows, it lists the 10 humanist commitments that shape the values that create a life worth living and a life that has a positive impact on humankind and the planet. And is meant to be for children, so maybe like in an RE instruction or a classroom context. I will read the list without defining those 10 commitments, but they are really important in terms of creating that life which is worth living and having a positive impact on the planet. Those commitments are critical thinking. Taking away the text. Thank you. Critical thinking, ethical development, peace and social justice, service and participation, altruism, humility, environmentalism, global awareness, responsibility, and empathy. 10 commandments that Tom spoke about this morning versus 10 commitments. One imposed by a supernatural deity about 6,000 years ago, the other the result of millions of years of human evolution. In our story of For All Ages, we were introduced to a young girl and her mother traipsing through the woods to learn an important lesson of life, how to live a meaningful life and make decisions for oneself. Really? I get to choose? So her choice was, giving me this freedom, I think I'll be naughty. That'd be cool. But she learns that really, it wasn't fun to litter. It wasn't enjoyable to destroy flowers, splat mushrooms, squash living things. And furthermore, if you're going to become a scientist, a geologist, and you're going to study earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, you'd better do your homework. She was beginning to learn one of the 10 humanist commitments, thinking for yourself and owning the consequences. Now, while this is made for young people, I suspect that the idea of these 10 commitments would play very well for adults as well. Pretend for one moment, if you will, that you're a child. Select one of the 10. Maybe we need to work a little bit on humility, or we need to work a little bit on empathy. Practice reciting that commitment. Consider it your morning mantra. For 1 minute, every day for 1 week, you do that mantra. By the end of the week, you will be aware of two benefits. One, you'll be more self-aware of your commitment and perhaps even act on it. And two, your blood pressure will have declined 5 to 10 points. Several of the listed commitments were shown in this morning's video. Humility, critical thinking, compassion, global affairs, the environment. But I'd like to focus a little more on the various expressions of humanism. In my view, there are two major forms of humanism, secular and religious. Now, that's in my view. You understand what that comes with, all kinds of qualifications. But in my view, secular and religious. Secular humanism is based on three basic premises. One, there's no spiritual deity in the universe. Two, values are drawn from human experiences as portrayed in our video. And three, all knowledge statements must be supported by credible evidence. I'll comment a little later about identifying as an atheist. Religious humanism, in my view, again, has two subcategories. Some religious humanists are secular, but enjoy the rituals and mysteries of services, chalices, candles, bells, chimes, and minister garb in robes with stoles. Some proper humanists suggest that you have taken religion out of religion and then name it religion. A bit confusing, I know, but no matter. The second subcategory, in my view, are agnostics. Okay? Agnostics are religious humanists who are undecided about deities. The evidence is mixed. Like secular religious humanists, they too enjoy the rituals of services. Of course, there have been debates of one sort or another ever since the existence and substance of a divine God was created. In the mid-17th century, a monkish scientist, or a scientific monk, named Blaise Pascal, wrote a treatise on the advantages of believing in God. It's known as Pascal's Wager. It's actually a complicated logical mathematical argument, which we won't go into, but in the simpler language of Joe Biden, here's the deal. If there's no God, believers are advantaged in the religious community and lose nothing after death. If there is a God, believers are advantaged in both the present world and receive eternal life after death. In short, believing trumps not believing. I wonder what this might be an agnostic corollary. Not believing has always had risks and is perhaps why many atheists self-identify as being secular. Atheists do not share the advantages of most believers or agnostics. Blasphemy laws in 18 countries, all of them Muslim majority, provide for executions of atheists. Fortunately, the U.S. does not have blasphemy laws yet. But there are 8 states with constitutions that prohibit atheists from holding office. All but one is in the South. Want to guess which it is? I'll just tell you, it's not Indiana. The greater obstacle for atheists in the U.S. are faith, tradition, and ignorance. Case in point. Fast forward to a 17-year-old girl basketball player at Hardesty High School in Hardesty, Oklahoma. She was told she could not play basketball if she did not join the prayer circle that was traditionally held in the gym before the game. Appreciate that she was a very good player, and college scouts were interested in evaluating her skills. She could not be, she could be the grown version of the girl in our story for all ages. When asked why she refused to join other players in the reciting of the Lord's Prayer, she replied that she was an atheist and she didn't believe in God. Well, Hardesty, Oklahoma, it could have been Daleville, Indiana. It all hit the fan, as one might say. Her friends were shocked. An atheist? Many friends left her. She was ridiculed by team parents. She was scorned by school basketball fans. They can be brutal and crude. She finally dropped out of school. Her dream was to play basketball. Finally, her parents and the ACLU filed suit and settled out of court. She returned to school, was able to play, but and did not have to recite the Lord's Prayer, but was required to stand in the gym near the prayer circle before angry fans. Imagine the courage and integrity of a 17-year-old girl who had to withstand the scorn, isolation, ridicule, and humiliation for the right to perhaps fulfill her dream of creating a meaningful life playing basketball. Perhaps we should add integrity and courage to our list of humanist commitments. I think 12 would be a good number. Now, as billed in our Facebook and church e-blasts, the fifth source of our living traditions is the subject of the service. And I feel duty-bound to say something about it. Just like the JP who would not drop my fine for a traffic violation in Wabash, Indiana, the old coot said he was duty-bound to enforce the law. I think he needed the money. Let me share a story and then segue into the specifics of the fifth source of living traditions. The setting is the Lake District of England. And Holmes and Dr. Watson are hiking and camping. You probably didn't know they were hikers and campers, but they were. So one day after a long hike, they decided to set up camp, have dinner, share a few sips of sherry, and bed down. In the middle of the night, Holmes awoke and nudged Watson to wake him. Watson, when you look up the sky at night, what do you see? Watson kind of yawns. Well, my dear Holmes, I see millions of stars. And Holmes replies, and what do you infer from these observations? To which Watson says, astronomically, I observe there are millions of galaxies, billions of stars, and planets. Astrologically, I observe that Saturn is in Leo. Meteorologically, I expect the weather to be fine and clear. Theologically, I see God is all-powerful and man his creation, small and insignificant. After a long pause, Watson asks, what about you, Holmes? Watson, you idiot, someone has stolen our tent. Sometimes the most knowledgeable minds miss the most obvious events, which leads us to the fifth source of our living traditions, which encourages us to heed the guidance of reason and results of science, and warns against idolatries of the mind and spirit. Idolatries of the mind and spirit. The Reverend William Sinkford of First Unitarian Portland, Oregon, hello Portland, and former president of the UUA, delivered sermon on this very topic, idolatries of mind and spirit. And in that sermon, he suggested that the original interpretation of that phrase, idolatries of mind and spirit, was meant to protect humanism from the encroachment of dogmas and creeds of religious faiths. Today, he suggests that the phrase is really a caution against the idolatry of the partial truth over the whole truth. I don't know what that means. What is a partial truth? Rocks fall down, but sometimes they fall up. If it rains and you do not have an umbrella, you will get wet. But sometimes when it rains and you do not have an umbrella, you will not get wet. How many partial truths make a whole truth? Are all truths equal? Is there an ever so slight chance that the UU tent of humanism and reason, back to Mr. Holmes, the UU tent of humanism and reason, central pillars of UU thought, are ever so slightly disappearing as we gaze upon the mysteries of the night sky? Where is Holmes when you need him? Good question. And now, the final story. Why did God create atheists? There's a story in Hasidic literature that addresses this very question. The rabbi teaches the student that God created everything in the world to be appreciated, since everything here is to teach us a lesson. One clever student asked the rabbi, "What lesson can we learn from atheists? Why did God create them?" The rabbi responded, "God created atheists to teach us the most important lesson of them all, the lesson of true compassion." You see, when an atheist performs an act of charity, visits someone who is sick, helps someone in need, and cares for the world, he is not doing so because of religious teaching. He does not believe that God commanded him to perform this act. In fact, he does not believe in God at all. So his acts are based on an inner sense of morality. And look at the kindness he can bestow upon others. This means, the rabbi continued, that when someone reaches out to you for help, you should never say, "I pray that God will help you." Instead, for the moment, you should become an atheist. Imagine that there is no God who can help, and say, "I will help you." So be it.